WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville.
The rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
What was going on? A roar of laughter from the aphasia ward, just as the president's speech was coming on, and they had all been so eager to hear the president speaking. There he was, the old charmer, the actor, with his practiced rhetoric, his histrionisms, his emotional appeal, and all the patients were convulsed with laughter. Well, not all. Some looked bewildered, some looked outraged, one or two looked apprehensive, but most looked amused. The president was, as always, moving. But he was moving them, apparently, mainly to laughter. What could they be thinking? Were they failing to understand him? Or did they, perhaps, understand him all too well? It was often said of these patients, who, though intelligent, had the severest receptive or global aphasia, rendering them incapable of understanding words as such, that they, nonetheless, understood most of what was said to them. Their friends, their relatives, the nurses who knew them well, could hardly believe, sometimes, that they were aphasic. This was because, when addressed naturally, they grasped some or most of the meaning. Thus, to demonstrate their aphasia, one had to go to extraordinary lengths, as a neurologist, to speak and behave unnaturally, to remove all the extraverbal cues, tone of voice, intonation, suggestive emphasis or inflection, as well as all visual cues, one's expressions, one's gestures, one's entire, largely unconscious, personal repertoire and posture. One had to remove all of this, which might involve total concealment of one's person and total depersonalization of one's voice, even to using a computerized voice synthesizer, in order to reduce speech to pure words, speech totally devoid of what Frege called tone color, or evocation. With the most sensitive patients, it was only with such a grossly artificial, mechanical speech, somewhat like that of the computers in Star Trek, that one could be wholly sure of their aphasia. Why all this? Because speech, natural speech, does not consist of words alone, nor, as Hewlings Jackson thought, propositions alone. It consists of utterance, an uttering forth of one's whole meaning with one's whole being, the understanding of which involves infinitely more than mere word recognition. And this was the clue to the aphasiac's understanding, even when they might be wholly uncomprehending of words as such. For though the words, the verbal constructions per se, might convey nothing, spoken language is normally suffused with tone, embedded in an expressiveness which transcends the verbal. And it is precisely this expressiveness, so deep, so various, so complex, so subtle, which is perfectly preserved in aphasia, though understanding of words be destroyed, preserved and, often more, preternaturally enhanced. This too becomes clear, often in the most striking or comic or dramatic way, to all those who work or live closely with aphasiacs, their families or friends or nurses or doctors. At first, perhaps, we see nothing much the matter, and then we see that there has been a great change, almost an inversion, in their understanding of speech. Something has gone, has been devastated, it is true, but something has come in its stead, and has been immensely enhanced, so that, at least with emotionally laden utterance, the meaning may be fully grasped even when every word is missed. This, in our species, homo loquens, seems almost an inversion of the usual order of things. An inversion, and perhaps a reversion, too, to something more primitive and elemental. And this, perhaps, is why Hulings Jackson compared aphasiacs to dogs, a comparison that might outrage both. Though, when he did this, he was chiefly thinking of their linguistic incompetencies, rather than their remarkable and almost infallible sensitivity to tone and feeling. Henry Head, more sensitive in this regard, speaks of feeling tone in his 1926 treatise on aphasia, and stresses how it is preserved and often enhanced in aphasiacs. Thus, the feeling I sometimes have, which all of us who work closely with aphasiacs have, that one cannot lie to an aphasiac. He cannot grasp your words, and so cannot be deceived by them. But what he grasps with infallible precision, namely, the expression that goes with the words, that total, spontaneous, involuntary expressiveness, which can never be simulated or faked, as words alone can, all too easily. We recognize this with dogs, and often use them for this purpose, to pick up falsehood or malice or equivocal intentions, to tell us who can be trusted, who is integral, who makes sense, when we, so susceptible to words, cannot trust our own instincts. And what dogs can do here, aphasiacs too, and at a human and immeasurably superior level. One can lie with the mouth, Nietzsche writes, but with the accompanying grimace one nevertheless tells the truth. To such a grimace, to any falsity or impropriety in bodily appearance or posture, aphasiacs are preternaturally sensitive, and if they cannot see one, this is especially true of our blind aphasiacs, they have an infallible ear for every vocal nuance, the tone, the rhythm, the cadences, the music, the subtlest modulations, inflections, intonations, which can give or remove verisimilitude to or from a man's voice. In this, then, lies their power of understanding. Understanding, without words, what is authentic or inauthentic. Thus it was the grimaces, the histrionisms, the false gestures, and, above all, the false tones and cadences of the voice, which rang false for these wordless but immensely sensitive patients. It was to these, for them, most glaring, even grotesque, incongruities and improprieties that my aphasic patients responded, undeceived and undeceivable by words. This is why they laughed at the president's speech. If one cannot lie to an aphasiac, in view of his special sensitivity to expression and tone, how is it, we might ask, with patients, if there are such, who lack any sense of expression and tone, while preserving unchanged their comprehension for words, patients of an exactly opposite kind? We have a number of such patients, also on the aphasia ward, although technically they do not have aphasia, but instead a form of agnosia, in particular a so-called tonal agnosia. For such patients, typically, the expressive qualities of voices disappear, their tone, their timbre, their feeling, their entire character, while words and grammatical constructions are perfectly understood. Such tonal agnosias are associated with disorders of the right temporal lobe of the brain, whereas the aphasias go with disorders of the left temporal lobe. Among the patients with tonal agnosia on our aphasia ward, who also listened to the president's speech, was Emily D., with a glioma in her right temporal lobe, a former English teacher and poetess of some repute, with an exceptional feeling for language and strong powers of analysis and expression. Emily D. was able to articulate the opposite situation, how the president's speech sounded to someone with tonal agnosia. Emily D. could no longer tell if a voice was angry, cheerful, sad, whatever. Since voices now lacked expression, she had to look at people's faces, their postures and movements when they talked, and found herself doing this with a care and intensity she had never shown before. But this, it so happened, was also limited, because she had a malignant glaucoma and was rapidly losing her sight, too. What she then found she had to do was to pay extreme attention to exactness of words and word use, and to insist that those around her did just the same. She could less and less follow loose speech or slang, speech of an elusive or emotional kind, and more required of her interlocutors that they speak prose, proper words in proper places. Prose, she found, might compensate in some degree for a lack of perceived tone or feeling. In this way, she was able to perceive, even enhance, the use of expressive speech, in which the meaning was wholly given by the apt choice and reference of words, despite being more and more lost with evocative speech, where meaning is wholly given in the use and sense of tone. Emily D. also listened, stony-faced, to the president's speech, bringing to it a strange mixture of enhanced and defective perceptions, precisely the opposite mixture to those of our aphasiacs. It did not move her, no speech now moved her, and all that was evocative, genuine, or false completely passed her by. Deprived of emotional reaction, was she then, like the rest of us, transported or taken in? By no means. "He is not cogent," she said. "He does not speak good prose. His word use is improper. Either he is brain damaged, or he has something to conceal." Thus, the president's speech did not work for Emily D. either, due to her enhanced sense of formal language use, propriety as prose, any more than it worked for our aphasiacs, with their word deafness but enhanced sense of tone. Here, then, was the paradox of the president's speech. We normals, aided doubtless by our wish to be fooled, were indeed well and truly fooled. And so cunningly was deceptive word use combined with deceptive tone that only the brain damaged remained intact, undeceived.
The president being referred to was Ronald Reagan, who was dubbed the great communicator by the media at the time. Emily D., however, was correct on both counts. It was later revealed that Reagan indeed had brain damage as a result of Alzheimer's, and he repeatedly lied to the public as well. And that was a reading from the book by the neurologist Oliver Sacks titled The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat and Other Clinical Tales, published in 1987. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Social systems are maintained by a social consensus. The stories that people believe to be true about the society, its leaders, and themselves as members of the society. These stories determine what is normal and acceptable. Even the most repressive governments must have the willing cooperation of enough of the people to wield the guns and clubs and man the prisons and torture chambers on behalf of the state against others in the society. Nazi propagandists deliberately employed a technique they called the big lie. They said, the bigger the lie, the easier it is to present it repetitively and have it be widely believed. One would think that the more outrageous the lie, the easier it would be to spot and neutralize. Yet the success the Nazis had shows that their technique was effective. Tonight on the program, spells and counterspells and viruses of the mind, and more from Disciplined Minds.
Peaceful efforts to disarm the Iraqi regime have failed again and again. Weapons of mass destruction. Weapons of mass destruction. This is not a question of authority. It is a question of will. Weapons of mass destruction. Weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours. Weapons of mass destruction. Weapons of mass destruction. Their refusal to do so will result in military conflict at a time of our choosing. Weapons of mass destruction.
The government has decided to commit Australian forces because we believe it is right. It is lawful, and it's in Australia's national interest.
And again.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Destruction.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Destruction.
Speaker, sir, with your permission, I should like to make a statement. Today we published a 50-page dossier detailing the history of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction.
And again.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Destruction.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Destruction. Weapons of mass destruction.
Laurel Ripple, 21, is everything we say we want our young people to be. Smart, driven, socially conscious. When she was a senior at Mast Academy, Laurel delivered 3,000 postcards to Miami-Dade Mayor Alex Penelas, signed by high school students opposed to his plan to build an airport on the edge of the Everglades. A member of the Sierra Club since she was a teenager, Ripple spent the last 6 months encouraging college students like herself to come to Miami and oppose the free trade area of the Americas. On November 21st, Laurel was part of a vigil outside the county jail for the protesters arrested the day before. After 3 hours, the Miami-Dade police ordered everyone to leave. As anyone who watched the scene unfold live on television can attest, the police moved forward on the crowd of 100 people, cutting off about 40 protesters and trapping them against a chain-link fence. The front line of the police all had shields, and they kept pushing in, pinning us against the fence, recalls Laurel, who grew up in South Miami. After a few minutes, Laurel said she fell to the ground and covered her head, whereupon an officer grabbed her wrists with one hand, lifted her arms, and began blasting her with pepper spray. "I started screaming in pain," Laurel says. "He had held the canister so close to my face that my hair and face were dripping with pepper spray." In the melee, she said she badly twisted her ankle. She was taken to a makeshift jail in Arlington Heights for processing and decontamination. "Because I couldn't walk, they dragged me," she recalls. "They had a shower set up in the parking lot. Two officers held me up as I was drenched for a few seconds with water. I was then dragged into this tent. It was dark. There were 4 men in white biohazard suits. I'm still coughing and crying from the pepper spray. I can't really tell what is happening." With her hands still bound behind her back, she said she felt her T-shirt coming apart. "That's when I realized they had scissors and they were cutting my clothes off me," she says. She said she begged them to stop, saying she could take her own clothes off, and she asked why there wasn't a female officer present. "They didn't say anything to me," she says, her hands shaking as she lights a cigarette. "No one ever said a word to me while they were doing this. After they cut my shirt off, they cut off my jeans and my underwear. I'm standing there totally naked. I felt completely violated. It was humiliating." Wearing a set of surgical scrubs, she was booked into jail barefoot and claims she never received medical attention for her ankle. Her criminal charge? Unlawful assembly, a misdemeanor. Sergeant Pete Andrew, a spokesman for the Miami-Dade Police Department, said he could neither confirm nor deny Laurel was pepper sprayed by police. The, quote, chemical agent could have been released by one of the protesters, he said. He also doubted she had ever asked for medical help. The decontamination, he added, was done by the Miami-Dade Fire Department. The fire department said Laurel received standard treatment for, quote, gross decontamination. "If we had permitted her to remove her own clothes, she could have recontaminated herself," said the fire department spokesman, Lieutenant Eugene Germain, Jr. "I wonder how Penelas or Miami-Dade Mayor Manny Diaz would feel if their wives or their children were put through such a process." Jonathan Ullman, South Florida field representative for the Sierra Club, saw Laurel being arrested on television. "She's a great kid," he says. "I couldn't believe it." Ullman called the Washington office of the Sierra Club, which dispatched attorneys to get Laurel out of jail within a few hours. The Sierra Club's executive director wrote President Bush this month demanding a Justice Department investigation into Laurel's arrest and the allegations of police misconduct made by other Sierra Club members. So far, there has been no response. Laurel's next court date is December 30th. And that was from the December 21st edition of the Miami Herald. Veteran activist Starhawk, whose account and analysis of the FTAA protests I read last week on the program, conceptualizes the barrage of corporate state propaganda as a spell that can be fought with a counterspell. Earlier this month, she gave a workshop in Brisbane, Australia. The recording is a little off mic, and I've done what I can to improve the listenability, but it was just too relevant to pass up. She begins by reading a passage from her latest book, Webs of Power, Notes from the Global Uprising.
The days are short and cold. The streets are uninviting. This is written right after September 11th. The political climate seems as chilly as the winter winds, and everybody is saying that September 11th changed everything. Why take action now? The government, the media, even some of our own allies warn us that public opinion is no longer with us, that repression will be high, that any action we take will be too costly, both personally and politically, that we should hold back and wait. But the WTO, the IMF, the World Bank, and the other institutions of corporate capitalism are not waiting. They continue to meet, to argue for a new round of trade negotiations, to impose policies that result in a widening gap between rich and poor, and a staggering global death toll. And so on bad days, we hear our own inner voices murmuring, it's hopeless, we're lost. The forces we face are too strong for us. Give up. These voices seem reasonable, sensible, but any witch can recognize a spell being cast. A spell is a story we tell ourselves that shapes our emotional and psychic world. The media, the authorities tell a story so pervasive that most people mistake it for reality. We're fighting a righteous war against the source of all evil, and everyone supports Bush, and corporate control is the only way to be safe and to provide what we need, and to question is evil too. The counterspell is simple. Tell a different story. So I want to talk a little bit about the stories we tell and are told. We were doing some work on that today in the workshop, and thinking about, because I was saying how I have become aware that, you know, political reality and people's commitment to their political goals is not actually usually based on things like reality and facts. It's often based on who they believe and the stories they're told and the stories they tell themselves. And some of those big stories that shape our realities, you know, are the stories, sort of the overarching story of this political economic system that you can call neoliberalism or global corporate capitalism, the sort of, you know, ultimate manifestation of this economic system and the colonialism of the last 500 years, this phase we're in now. You know, it's basically a story that kind of goes like this. It says, well, hey, you guys, yeah, we're the go-getting aggressive corporate guys. You stop holding us back with your fussy rules and regulations that remind us of our mothers nagging at us to clean our rooms. You know, if you stop hamstringing us with government restrictions and all of that, if you just let us go, we'll go out there in the world and we'll create so much wealth that everybody in the world will be better off and you can be part of it too. And that's what they're trying to sell us. And their favorite slogan is, a rising tide lifts all boats, which if you think about it is a slogan that's seriously not only unclear on the concept of the economy, it's unclear on the concept of tide. You know, they're trying to say if you're in a yacht or you're in a rowboat, you know, the economy's expanding, it's growing, you're going to be uplifted by it all. But, you know, tides don't rise forever. Tides rise and fall. And a tide that rises forever is no longer a tide. It's a global disaster. And economies can't expand forever in a world of finite resources. So, there, you know, this is a story that sort of at a certain point starts to intersect with reality in a painful way, because it doesn't actually work. It's a promise that does not bear fruit. You know, we have not seen the third world become better and better off from the two decades of free trade policies and policies imposed by institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund that involve basically taking government out of anything that actually supports anything nice for human beings, you know, anything like health or education or the next generation or arts, and privatizing every area of human services and putting all of that back into the realm of profit-making for transnational corporations. And you would probably think, if you thought about it on your own, that this would not actually create a lot of benefits for most people. And you would be right. The third world has gone downhill or hit a standstill in the last 20 years since it's had these policies imposed on it. And what we see now is, even in relatively prosperous countries like Australia and the U.S., in the U.S., we now have the greatest disparity of wealth that we've had since the 1920s. The top 1% of our population owns as much disposable income as the bottom 40%. I don't think it's quite that bad in Australia yet, but on the other hand, if you sign the U.S.-Australia Free Trade Agreement, it might soon become that way. So you have something to look forward to. You can become more like us. I see somebody shuddering there. Like, please, administer oxygen to this poor woman. You know, this story is backed by another story, and that's sort of the old patriarchal story about power. And it's kind of the story that says, you know, the only real power, the only real model of strength in the world is power over, is power backed by brute force. Many years ago, I was married to a guy up until the time I came home from a long trip, and he had put a bumper sticker on his van that said, "Force, it works." At that point, I started to realize this relationship was over. But that is the motto of that story, and that when it comes right down to it, it's all about force and violence. And that sort of is a story guiding our U.S. foreign policy. I remember right before September 11th hearing one of our generals on the radio talking about our overflights of Iraq and how they were against the law, international law. He said, well, yeah, they are against international law, but we're following an older law than that, the law that says we're bigger than you and we're stronger than you, so what are you going to do about it? That kind of story is necessary to back up the false promise of this economic story, because as it doesn't work for people and people start to stop buying into the system and the promise of the system, and people start to say things like, well, wait a minute, it does make a difference if you're in a yacht or a rowboat and we're tired of being in the rowboats, and they can no longer sell it to us, the next step is to say, well, you know, if you won't buy into it voluntarily, you can buy into it because you have no alternative. Because if you don't, we have the biggest military on the planet, and what are you going to do about it? And that has been our policy with the third world for a long time, and it's still our policy around many, many aspects of it, overtly or somewhat more subtly, from trying to force Africa to take genetically modified foods if it wants food aid, to the blatant overt going into Iraq. So that's another story, and it's also backed by yet another story, which is sort of the racism story that says, well, there's some people in the world that are kind of like the real people, and everybody else is like the filler, the people that aren't really important or aren't sort of really as real as you are, or if they are, they're kind of evil, dangerous, you know, you got to be afraid of them. And that story has many, many variations, but it always sort of backs up the rule of force and these other stories. So that's a bunch of spells being cast, and they're all kind of reinforced you know, by an underlying spell that's constantly whispering to us and saying things like, and you know what, this is how it is, and it's always been this way, and therefore it always will be this way, and there's nothing you can do about it. And you know, if that's the psychic world you're living in, it's a pretty grim and dismal place. And it's not surprising that we have so much despair and so much drug addiction and so much craziness and so much depression and so much general dysfunction if those are the cultural stories that we're hearing. I think when we start to work against them, we often get caught up in some of our own stories that can be almost as dismal. You know, I was saying earlier, you know, as environmentalists, we're often trying to sell people the story that says, well, you know what, the earth would be better off without us. And you can make a case for that, sometimes a good case, but you can't mobilize people around that. You can't inspire people around that idea. It doesn't really kind of lead you nowhere to go. I think we could be weaving a different spell. You know, we could be weaving a much more powerful and positive and beautiful spell, and a spell that would empower us rather than disempower us. And that story goes something like this. We're actually here on a living being. This planet is alive, and we're part of that life. And you can call her Gaia or Goddess or whatever you want, but she's not only alive, she's incredibly creative and resilient. And if you want to tell the story in detail, you can go through all the different phases of life and evolution and creativity and amazing transformations that this planet has been through, from coming up with life in the first place, which is a pretty amazing thing. You know, started off really as just, you know, these double spiral molecules that could somehow split and reproduce themselves and packaged themselves with a little sack around them and filled the seas and gobbled up every other big molecule until the point where they all began to die off of hunger. And at that point, came up with the most incredible thing that has ever happened on this planet, really. You know, back before there was a single brain, before there was even, not only was there no scientist, you know, there was nobody to even think of having a scientist, because there was no brain to think with. There was nothing but bacteria, anaerobic bacteria. There was not even any oxygen to speak of in the atmosphere. And these stinking little bacteria, the ones that you try to avoid in your compost heap and you, you know, don't like to smell in your gut, you know, they came up with the most amazingly beautiful mandala molecule of chlorophyll that had this incredible capacity to take sunlight, vibrate with it, transform it into energy, and use that to break the bonds of carbon dioxide and turn it into usable carbon to build a body with, and sugars and food for themselves and everything else. And a whole new bunch of life was born. That's a pretty amazing story when you think about it. And so if we start to think that we live on this kind of creative planet and we're part of that life, it makes it possible to approach the current situation, I think, with a little more optimism and hope. The other part of that story that I think we have to begin to tell ourselves and tell other people is that we as human beings actually have an important role to play on the planet, that she would not be better off without us. She really likes us. She wants us. You know, we're supposed to be doing something. Just like your brain is supposed to be playing a role with the rest of your body. And it's true that your body can function with a big chunk of your brain destroyed, but it can't function as well as it can if you're alive and thinking and looking and reflecting. And I think that that's what we're actually supposed to be here. Is we are supposed to be part of the goddess's brain and focused consciousness that can reflect back on what's happening, that can admire it, that can watch it, that can look at it, that can intervene sensitively to help in its evolution towards even yet more beauty, balance, delight, diversity, creativity. And most indigenous cultures on the planet, you know, sort of got that. And a lot of their lives and a lot of their culture and a lot of their spirituality involved how do you interact with nature, how do you watch the land, how do you tend the land, how do you play that role that we're supposed to play. They don't go around talking about the earth wanting to get rid of us. Mabel McKay, who's a wonderful teacher among the Pomo, who are the original people of the land where I live, she used to say, if you don't use the plants, if you don't eat what they give you, if you don't talk to them, if you don't praise them, they'll die. But they really depend on that interaction with us for something that they also need and want. So if we start telling ourselves a story like that, you know, there's some other parts to it that go with it. And part of that, again, I think as environmentalists, as activists, we're often telling a story of scarcity. Telling people, you know, there isn't enough to go around, and we've got to get do less, and we can't have as much, and you're greedy, and you're bad. And there is scarcity in the world in the sense that, you know, that rising tide thing can't really work in a world of finite resources in the way it's put forth. Sooner or later, and probably much sooner than we want to think, we're going to run out of some important things. We basically already run out of things like old growth forest. I don't know anywhere, there may be some wonderful places on the earth where there's still enough old growth forest that you could go in and log it and it wouldn't affect the ecosystem, but I know where I live in California, there's probably less than 2 to 3% of the old growth redwoods left that were there 150 years ago. The vast majority of the stuff is already gone, and there's so little left in most places of the world that a really sensible thing to do would be to just leave it alone, not cut it, protect it, tend it, preserve it, admire it. You know, we're close to running out of oil, which is the thing that keeps the whole fiction afloat. Not that we're going to run out of it. We're not going to run out of it for a long, long time, but we're close to hitting the point where it starts to become more and more expensive to extract it. And the price of it has to rise, and when that happens, sort of the whole balance of things has to shift. So there's definite limiting factors that need to be taken into consideration. But those limiting factors don't have to turn into a kind of scarcity that says you can't have what you need, or you can only have what you barely need, but you can't have what you want. I think we can start telling people a much different story, and the story goes like this. You know, if we shift our way of doing things, if we start to work with nature instead of against nature, take nature as our model, she really does create abundance for us all. And that abundance is going to maybe take different forms. You know, it might not look like everyone having their SUV or their two or three of them in the garage of their mini mansion. But it might look something like everybody on earth having good quality, healthy, vibrant, organic, locally grown food that provides them with a nutritious diet and delicious stuff to eat. It might mean people having gardens. It might mean people actually having the time they need to spend with their families and their friends and not working all the time in a windowless office downtown so they can pay for that SUV and mini mansion. It might mean things like people actually having time to participate in their communities and participate in real democracy, which is not a spectator sport. You know, it requires participation, and it requires things like going to meetings and taking responsibility for what's going on in your area and working for change and thinking about the issues and talking about them and discussing them. And, you know, that kind of level of participation is exciting. It's more exciting, actually, than like watching what happened to the latest love affair of the latest celebrity on TV. All right, maybe it's not quite as exciting. So I think when we start telling those stories, it starts to throw us into a different world. It throws us into a world that's alive, that's dynamic, that's animate. It's the world that we've talked about a lot with the goddess tradition, you know, which is really just another way of saying a living earth, a living being, that we're not in a bunch of dead stuff out here, you know, that the trees really are talking to us, you know, and you really can talk back to them, and we really are part of it all, and that part of it all is something that we should be celebrating, and something that we should be enjoying, and we can participate in it, and we can love it, and we can love it so fiercely and so passionately that we want to stand up for it, we want to fight for it, we want to do stuff to preserve it and protect it and take care of it. And when we tell that story, I think it also moves us into the stories that we can tell about activism, about change.
That was Starhawk speaking on December 15th in Brisbane, Australia. Starhawk is the author of 8 books on feminism, activism, nonviolence, and Wicca. For more information on her work, visit her website at starhawk.org. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. Central to most religion is submission to the will of an omnipotent God whose ways must not be questioned. Tyrannical government follows a similar paradigm. There is an ancient relationship, in fact, between religion and monarchy. Kings were said to hold their power by divine right, and in some cases claimed they themselves were gods. Are those struggling for a truly free and democratic society battling some genetic human predisposition to subordination? What explains the resurgence of religious fundamentalism, including at the highest levels of government, in the face of expanding scientific discovery? Richard Dawkins is an evolutionary biologist who teaches at Oxford University. He's famous for advancing the concept of the selfish gene, but also for arguing against religion and for a humanistic ethics. He spoke last November at Harvard on the role of religion from the evolutionary perspective. Towards the end of the talk, we hear another voice, that of Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker, whose work has covered similar ground.
It is with trepidation and humility that I come from the oldest university in the English-speaking world to what must surely be the greatest. My trepidation is not lessened by the title that, perhaps unwisely, I gave the organizers all those months ago. Anybody who publicly belittles religion, however gently, can expect hate mail of a uniquely unforgiving species. But the very fact that religion arouses such passions catches a scientist's attention. I am a Darwinian student of animal behavior and a student of Nico Tinbergen. You won't be surprised, therefore, if I talk about animals. As a Darwinian, the aspect of religion that catches my attention is its profligate wastefulness, its extravagant display of baroque uselessness. Is the projector on? Is it good? Nature is a miserly accountant, grudging the pennies, watching the clock, punishing the smallest waste. If a wild animal habitually performs some useless activity, natural selection will favor rival individuals who devote the time instead to surviving and reproducing. Nature cannot afford frivolous jeu d'esprit. Ruthless utilitarianism trumps, even if it doesn't always seem that way. A male bird of paradise, extravagant though he seems, would be penalized by females if he were less so. The same is true of the time and labor that a male bowerbird puts into making his bower. Anting, the odd habit of birds such as jays of bathing in an ant's nest, apparently inciting the ants to invade the feathers. Nobody knows for sure what the benefit of anting is, perhaps some kind of hygiene cleansing the feathers of parasites. My point is that uncertainty as to detail doesn't, nor should it, stop Darwinians believing with great confidence that anting must be for something. Such a confident stance is controversial at Harvard, if nowhere else. And you may be aware of the totally unwarranted slur that functional hypotheses are untestable, just-so stories. There's nowhere I'd rather see a test of functional hypotheses done than at Harvard. So I wish I had time to go into this matter. If anybody wants to ask me about it afterwards, I'd be delighted to suggest a piece of research. Religious behavior in bipedal apes occupies large quantities of time. It devours huge resources. A medieval cathedral would consume hundreds of man-centuries in the building. Sacred music and devotional paintings largely monopolized medieval and Renaissance talent. Thousands, perhaps millions of people have died, often accepting torture first, for loyalty to one religion rather than a scarcely distinguishable alternative. Devout people have died for their gods, killed for them, fasted for them, whipped blood from their backs, undertaken a lifetime of celibacy, sworn themselves to asocial silence for the sake of religion. Nobody does this kind of list better than Steven Pinker. And I'm going to quote How the Mind Works on the peculiar problems you face in this country, whether in spite of or because of the constitutional separation of church and state, I don't know. Pinker says, according to polls, more than a quarter of today's Americans believe in witches, almost half believe in ghosts, half believe in the devil, half believe that the book of Genesis is literally true, 69% believe in angels, 87% believe that Jesus was raised from the dead, and 96% believe in a god or universal spirit. More generally, Pinker remarks, in culture after culture, people believe that the soul lives on after death, that rituals can change the physical world and divine the truth, and that illness and misfortune are caused and alleviated by spirits, ghosts, saints, fairies, angels, demons, cherubim, jinns, devils, and gods. Though the details differ across cultures, no known culture lacks some version of the time-consuming, wealth-consuming, hostility-provoking, fecundity-forfeiting rituals of religion. And all this presents a major puzzle to anyone who thinks in a Darwinian way. We guessed why Jay's aunt, my old maestro Nico Tinbergen, did an experimental test of why seagulls remove empty eggshells from the nest. They're conspicuous and attract predators. So isn't religion a challenge, an a priori affront to Darwinism, demanding similar explanation? Why do we pray and indulge in costly practices which in individual cases more or less totally consume our lives? Of course, the caveats must now come tumbling in. Religious behavior is Darwinian business only if it is widespread, not some weird anomaly. Apparently it is universal, and the problem won't go away just because the details differ across cultures. As with language, the underlying phenomenon is universal, though it plays out differently in different regions. Not all individuals are religious, as I would guess most of this educated audience will testify. But religion is a human universal. Every culture, everywhere in the world, has a style of religion which even non-practitioners recognize as the norm for that society, just as it has a style of clothing, a style of courting, and a style of meal serving. Could it be a recent phenomenon sprung up since our genes underwent most of their natural selection? Its ubiquity argues against any simple version of that idea. But there is a version of it which it'll be my main purpose to advocate today. The propensity that was naturally selected in our ancestors was not religion per se. It had some other benefit, and it only incidentally manifests itself as religious behavior. We'll understand religious behavior only after we have renamed it. Once again, it's natural for me as an ethologist to use an example from non-human animals. The dominance hierarchy was first discovered as the pecking order in hens. Each hen learns which individual she can beat in a fight and which beat her. In a well-established dominance hierarchy, little overt fighting is seen. Stable groupings of hens who've had time to sort themselves into a dominance hierarchy lay more eggs than groups of hens whose membership is continually changed. This might suggest an advantage to the phenomenon of the dominance hierarchy. But that's not good Darwinism, because the dominance hierarchy is a group-level phenomenon. Farmers may care about group productivity, but natural selection doesn't. For a Darwinian, the question, what is the survival value of the dominance hierarchy, is an illegitimate question. The proper question is something like, what is the individual survival value of deferring to stronger hens and of punishing lack of deference from weaker ones? Darwinian questions have to direct attention toward the level at which genetic variation might exist. Aggressive or deferring tendencies in individual hens are a proper target because they either do or easily might vary genetically. Group phenomena, like dominance hierarchies, don't in themselves vary genetically because groups don't have genes. Or at least you'll have to make some special case if you want to argue that a group phenomenon could be subject to genetic variation. You might contrive it via some version of what I've called the extended phenotype, but I'm too skeptical to accompany you there. My point, of course, is that religion may be like the dominance hierarchy. What is the survival value of religion is the wrong question. The right question may have something like the form, what is the survival value of some as yet unspecified individual behavior or psychological characteristic which manifests itself under appropriate circumstances as religion? We have to rewrite the question before we can sensibly answer it. I must first acknowledge that other Darwinians have gone straight for the unrewritten question and proposed direct Darwinian advantages of religion itself, as opposed to psychological predispositions that accidentally manifest themselves as religion. There is a little evidence that religious belief protects people from stress-related diseases. The evidence is not good, but it wouldn't be at all surprising. A non-negligible part of what a doctor can provide for a patient is consolation and reassurance. My doctor doesn't literally practice the laying on of hands, but many is the time I've been instantly cured of some minor ailment by a reassuringly calm voice from an intelligent face surmounting a stethoscope. The placebo effect is well documented. Dummy pills with no pharmacological activity at all demonstrably improve health, and that's why drug trials have to be double-blind controlled. It's why homeopathic remedies appear to work, even though they're so dilute that they have the same amount of the active ingredient as the placebo control, zero molecules. That's literally true, that's not true. Is religion, then, a medical placebo which prolongs life by reducing stress? Perhaps, although the theory is going to have to run the gauntlet of skeptics who point out the many circumstances in which religion increases stress rather than decreases it. In any case, I find the placebo theory too meager to account for the massive, all-pervasive, worldwide phenomenon of religion. I do not think we have religion because our religious ancestors reduced their stress levels and hence survived longer. I don't think that's a big enough theory for the job. Other theories miss the point of Darwinian explanations altogether. I mean suggestions like religion satisfies our curiosity about the universe and our place in it, or religion is consoling. People fear death and are drawn to religions which promise we'll survive it. There may be some psychological truth here, but it's not in itself a Darwinian explanation. Again, to quote Steven Pinker, it only raises the question of why a mind would evolve to find comfort in beliefs it can plainly see are false. A freezing person finds no comfort in believing he's warm. A person face to face with a lion is not put at ease by the conviction that it is a rabbit. A Darwinian version of the fear of death theory would have to be of the form, belief in survival after death tends to postpone the moment when it is put to the test. This could be true or it could be false. Maybe it's another version of the stress and placebo theory, but I shan't pursue the matter. My only point is that that's the kind of way in which a Darwinian must rewrite the question. Psychological statements that people find some belief agreeable or disagreeable are proximate, not ultimate, explanations. And Darwinians make much of this distinction between proximate and ultimate. Proximate questions lead us into physiology and neuroanatomy. There's nothing wrong with proximate explanations. They're important, they're scientific, but as it happens, my preoccupation today is with Darwinian ultimate explanations. If neuroscientists, such as the Canadian Michael Persinger, find a God center in the brain, Darwinian scientists like me would want to know why the God center evolved. Why did those of our ancestors who had a genetic tendency to grow a God center survive better than rivals who did not? The ultimate Darwinian question is not a better question, not a more profound question, not a more scientific question than the proximate neurological question, but it's the one I'm talking about today. Some alleged ultimate explanations turn out to be, or in some cases avowedly are, group selection theories. Group selection is the controversial idea that Darwinian selection chooses among groups of individuals in the same kind of way as it chooses among individuals within groups. For example, the Cambridge anthropologist Colin Renfrew suggests that Christianity survived by a form of group selection because it fostered the idea of in-group loyalty and brotherly love. And the American evolutionist D.S. Wilson has made a similar suggestion. Here's a made-up example to show what a group selection theory of religion might look like. A tribe with a stirringly belligerent god of battles wins wars against a tribe whose god urges peace and harmony, or a tribe with no god at all. Warriors who believe a martyr's death will send them straight to paradise fight bravely and willingly give up their lives. So tribes with certain kinds of religion are more likely to survive in intertribal selection and steal the conquered tribe's cattle and women as concubines and so on. And such successful tribes spawn daughter tribes who go off and propagate more daughter tribes and so on, all worshipping the same tribal god. Note that that's different from saying that the idea of the warlike religion survives. Of course, it will, but in this case, the point is that the group of people who hold the idea survive. There are formidable objections to group selection theories. As a partisan in the controversy, I must beware of riding off on a hobby horse far from today's subject. So I'll go straight back to the idea of rewriting the question. I previously cited the pecking order in hens, and the point so central to my thesis, I hope you'll forgive another animal example to ram it home. Moths fly into the candle flame, and it doesn't look like an accident. They go out of their way to make a burnt offering of themselves. We could label it self-immolation behavior and wonder how Darwinian selection could possibly favor it. And my point again, of course, is that we need to rewrite the question before we can attempt an intelligent answer. It isn't suicide. Apparent suicide emerges as an inadvertent side effect. Artificial light is a recent arrival on the night scene. Until recently, the only night lights were the moon and the stars. Being at optical infinity, their rays are parallel, which makes them ideal compasses. Insects are known to use celestial objects to steer accurately in a straight line. The insect nervous system is adept at setting up a temporary rule of thumb, such as steer a course such that the light rays hit your eye at an angle of 30 degrees. And since insects have compound eyes, this will amount to favoring a particular ommatidium. But the light compass relies critically on the celestial object being at optical infinity. If it isn't, the rays are not parallel, but diverge like the spokes of a wheel. A nervous system using a 30-degree rule of thumb to a candle, as though it were the moon, will steer its moth in a neat logarithmic spiral into the flame. It's still, on average, a good rule of thumb. We don't notice the hundreds of moths who are silently and effectively steering by the moon or a bright star or even the lights of a distant city. We see only moths hurling themselves at our candles. And we ask the wrong question. Why are all these moths committing suicide? Instead, we should ask why they have nervous systems that steer by maintaining an automatic fixed angle to light rays, a tactic which we only notice on the occasions when it goes wrong. When the question is rephrased, the mystery evaporates. It never was right to call it suicide. And once again, we apply the lesson to religious behavior in humans. We observe large numbers of people in many local areas, 100%, who hold beliefs which flatly contradict demonstrable scientific facts as well as rival religions. They not only hold these beliefs, but devote time and resources to costly activities that flow from holding them. They die for them, kill for them. We marvel at all this, just as we marveled at the self-immolation behavior of the moths. And baffled, we ask why. Yet again, the point I'm making is that we may be asking the wrong question. The religious behavior may be a misfiring, an unfortunate manifestation of an underlying psychological propensity which in other circumstances was once useful. What might that psychological propensity have been? What is the equivalent of the parallel rays from the moon as a useful compass? I'm going to offer a suggestion, but I must stress that it's only an example of the kind of thing I'm talking about. I'm much more wedded to the general idea that the question should be properly put than I am to any particular answer. My specific hypothesis is about children. More than any other species, we survive by the accumulated experience of previous generations. Theoretically, children might learn from experience not to swim in crocodile-infested waters, for example. But to say the least, there'll be a selective advantage to child brains with a rule of thumb. Believe whatever your grown-ups tell you. Obey your parents. Obey the tribal elders, especially when they adopt a solemn, minatory tone. Obey without question. I've never forgotten a horrifying sermon preached in my school chapel when I was little. Horrifying in retrospect. At the time, my child brain accepted it as intended by the preacher.